Censorship in the media. Aside from inviting docile journalists to meetings and conferences and funding AIDS activist groups, the CDC and NIH have one other powerful tool for maintaining media cooperation. Eleanor Burkett, a courageous Miami Herald reporter who wrote a major article covering the HIV-AIDS debate, explained it best as a question of access. If you have an AIDS beat, you're a beat reporter. Your job is every day to go out there, fill your newspaper with what's new about AIDS. You write a story that questions the truth of the central AIDS hypothesis and what happened to me will happen to you. Nobody's going to talk to you. Now, if nobody will talk to you, if nobody at the CDC will ever return your phone call, you lose your competitive edge as an AIDS reporter. So it always keeps you in the mainstream because you need those guys to be your buddies. When you call the CDC on the phone, and I call them certainly on a regular basis when I was writing that piece, they say things to you like, "You will be responsible for people in Miami stopping using condoms if you write that article." Do I want people in Miami to stop using condoms? Of course not. There's all kinds of blackmail, and I don't mean overt blackmail. It's emotional blackmail of that sort, and it's the fact that exactly what I knew was going to happen happened, which is, I can't get a phone call returned by any of them. Faced with growing dissent against the HIV hypothesis since 1987, the generals in the war on AIDS have openly hinted at using such tactics. They have repeatedly made clear their preference that dissidents confine the debate to scientific circles, keeping it out of the public eye. When asked by one reporter to answer Peter Duisberg's challenge, David Baltimore instead condemned the entire viewpoint as irresponsible and pernicious, and 2 years later warned in a scientific letter that Duisberg's continued attempts to persuade the public to doubt the role of HIV and AIDS are not based on facts. Prominent retrovirus hunter Frank Lilly, deceased October 1995, a member of the original Presidential Commission on the HIV epidemic, angrily responded to a presentation by Duisberg at the Presidential AIDS Commission in New York in 1988 and declared, "I regret that it has become a public question." Upset by sporadic but growing media coverage of Duisberg, AMFAR sponsored a special scientific meeting in April of 1988. Supposedly, the conference would air all views on the cause of AIDS, but it was really an attempt to put Duisberg's theories to rest, admitted one of the many journalists present. Fauci stated the point more bluntly in 1989, declaring in an editorial that Duisberg's ideas were nonsense and complaining that his views were receiving too much publicity. Journalists who make too many mistakes, or who are sloppy, he warned, are going to find that their access to scientists may diminish. And in a 1993 letter to the journal Nature, two of the most powerful virologists in Italy bared their teeth. Your subtitle ends, "He should stop," or "We submit, should he be stopped?" For example, should he somehow be prevented from appearing on television to misinform individuals who are at risk from the disease? One approach would be to refuse television confrontations with Duisberg, as Tony Fauci and one of us managed to do at the opening day of the 7th International Conference on AIDS in Florence. One can't spread misinformation without an audience. Such threats do work when leveled by the well-funded AIDS establishment, frightening the media and overriding their natural fascination with such a newsworthy story. Based on internal documents faxed to Duisberg by an anonymous source, key officials of the United States government specifically engineered a strategy for suppressing the HIV debate in 1987 while Duisberg was still on leave at the NIH. The operation began on April 28th, less than a month after Duisberg's first paper on the HIV question appeared in Cancer Research, apparently because several journalists and homosexual activists began raising questions. That day, a memo was sent out from the Office of the Secretary of Health and Human Services, HHS, headed by the words, "Media Alert." Describing the situation created by Duisberg's paper, the staff member ominously noted that the article apparently went through the normal pre-publication process and should have been flagged at NIH. There is no reason any scientific paper should be flagged by any government agency. The staffer then pointed out the threat to the government. "This obviously has the potential to raise a lot of controversy. If this isn't the virus, how do we know the blood supply is safe? How do we know anything about transmission? How could you all be so stupid, and why should we ever believe you again? And we need to be prepared to respond. I have already asked NIH Public Affairs to start digging into this. Copies of the memo were addressed to the Secretary, Undersecretary, and Assistant Secretary of HHS, as well as to the Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs, the Chief of Staff, the Surgeon General, and the White House. A parallel memo was issued by the NIH on the same day. Its author was Florence Carlsberg, the public relations officer interviewed at about the same time by John Lauritsen, and the memo was addressed to top NIH officials. "I want to alert you about some incidents that have occurred in the last 2 to 4 hours," Carlsberg wrote. She listed several public inquiries about Duisburg and emphasized, "DHHS is quite anxious and is awaiting feedback re-NIH NCI response to and strategy for this provocative situation." Commenting that Bob Gallo and others have tried to educate Peter Duisburg re-HTLV-3, HIV, and AIDS, but it's hopeless. Carlsberg recommended creating a response team consisting of NIH epidemiologist William Blattner, Danny Bolognese, Anthony Fauci, and Robert Gallo to deal with the controversy. Perhaps the epidemiologic approach might be more productive in countering Peter's assertions. Within 2 days, Blattner drafted a 3-page memo. In it, he marshaled a list of evasions and pieces of circumstantial evidence that would later become the standard defense of the HIV hypothesis used by all scientists and government agencies. By June, he had reworked a third draft as a potential press release, but the memo was never released to the public. Instead, the NIH and other officials adopted a policy of silence, hoping to discourage further interest by the media. By December, the strategy was clearly failing. In another internal NIH memo dated December 30th, Carlsberg wrote a fellow staffer that the Blattner memo was not pursued in June because Paul, an NIH staffer, suggested at that time that this project be put aside temporarily, at least until necessary. She continued, "Alas, in the past few months, inquiries have been mounting. The calls and interests are mounting. Perhaps it's time to review and activate the attached statement." The statement, signed Florence and entitled HIV, the Cause of AIDS, contained at the bottom a handwritten response initialed PVN that read, "I guess it is time to get off the dime. This isn't going away." Get off the dime, they certainly did. The Blattner memo was apparently revised and expanded, and the names of Robert Gallo and Howard Temin were added as co-authors. It was published in July of 1988 as one half of the debate with Peter Duisburg in Science magazine. Naturally, the piece was not identified as the product of NIH planning. But that was to be the last time the AIDS establishment would publicly engage Duisburg in a debate. Heightened controversy, after all, might backfire on the NIH, attracting attention rather than discouraging media interest. Indeed, the major media were already learning of the controversy over HIV and were becoming curious. So the official war on AIDS turned to more covert tactics, such as quietly yanking the leash of access to pull the media into line. The McNeil-Lehrer News Hour sent camera crews to interview Duisburg in early 1988, planning to do a major segment on the controversy. But when the February 8th broadcast date arrived, the feature had been pulled. Apparently, AIDS officials had heard of its imminent airing and had intercepted it. A few months later, the program aired a short, tepid segment with half the time now taken up by Fauci debunking Duisburg. Meanwhile, the ABC daily program Good Morning America also discovered the story and arranged to fly Duisburg to New York for an in-studio interview. He arrived Sunday night, February 20th, and was booked into the Barbizon Hotel. But that very evening, he received a call from the studio to announce that something had come up and the interview was canceled. Turning on the television the next morning, he saw Fauci, connected by satellite, filling Duisburg's time slot and discussing every aspect of AIDS except the controversy over HIV. Pressured by the editor of the New York Native and other dissidents, a Good Morning America film crew eventually did fly to Berkeley, and a short segment was broadcast again, balanced with Fauci. The story repeated itself twice with the cable news network, CNN. The second time, for example, a film crew flew out to interview Duisberg, planning to broadcast a half-hour special during the 1991 International AIDS Conference in Italy. Once again, the show was killed at the last minute, and a shorter version, only a couple of minutes long, reached the airwaves long after the conference was over. A similar plan to interview Duisberg on national Italian television was also killed during the conference. One of the killers proudly identified himself in a letter to Nature. "Refuse television confrontations with Duisberg, as Tony Fauci and one of us managed to do at the opening day of the 7th International Conference on AIDS in Florence." The Larry King Live program, carried on CNN, scheduled a half-hour satellite interview with Duisberg for August 6, 1992. Suspicious that something might again go awry, Duisberg called the producer a few hours before live broadcast. "Sorry," she told him, "something urgent has just come up regarding the election." Duisberg turned on the television that evening to discover that he had been replaced, not by an election issue, but by Fauci and the president of AMFAR. Neither surprise guest mentioned the controversy over HIV, nor did Larry King. Duisberg has appeared on major national television only twice. The first time was on March 28, 1993, on the ABC magazine program Day One. Even in this case, according to one producer, Fauci tried to get the show canceled days before broadcast. On April 4, 1994, Duisberg got his second chance to make his case on national television. This time it would be on Ted Koppel's Nightline, which had promised it would be Fauci-proof. The interviewer hired by Koppel, Katie Mullis, who had just won the Nobel Prize for the new technique that AIDS scientists relied on so heavily to find traces of the elusive HIV, was not to be intimidated by anybody's AIDS speak, not even Fauci's. But when the program finally aired, a few months after taping, there was Fauci again. After 15 tape minutes for the dissidents, Mullis, Duisberg, and others, Fauci took over the balance of time debating Root Bernstein live on cofactors for HIV. Clearly, Fauci proves to be a faithful stand-in for Duisberg AIDS television programs, and he certainly can be counted on when it comes to AIDS thought control. Such influence with the media by AIDS officials extends overseas. An award-winning English producer aired a one-hour documentary on Duisberg and the HIV controversy in June of 1990, timed to coincide with the International AIDS Conference in San Francisco. The program, entitled The AIDS Catch, leaned in Duisberg's favor, and the British press lavished it with advance praise right up to the day of broadcast. But when the British medical and public health establishment retaliated with stern condemnations, the press turned around and began criticizing the program. After the show aired, the Terence Higgins Trust, an AIDS organization funded mostly by the British government and partly by Burroughs Wellcome, filed a legal complaint against the program that prevented its rebroadcast or further distribution. The long arm of the AIDS establishment reaches even the President of the United States. Jim Warner, a Reagan White House advisor critical of AIDS alarmism, heard about Duisberg and arranged to sponsor a debate in January of 1988. This would have forced the HIV issue into the public spotlight, but it was apparently canceled days ahead of time on orders from above. Nor has the print media been exempt from such pressure. The first national publication to show interest was Newsweek, where Duisberg met with a senior writer in March 1987. However, the magazine had just arranged a special honorary dinner for Robert Gallo in its Washington, D.C. office a few days hence. "Maybe a story could be done later," the writer told Duisberg. 4 years later, that day seemed to arrive shortly after an editorial in Nature that favored Duisberg. Photographers showed up at his laboratory taking photos for a story to appear immediately. But that article was canceled within days. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist John Crutzen, a former New York Times writer now on staff with the Chicago Tribune, discovered the controversy and became excited at the prospect of breaking a new investigative story. In November of 1987, he took Duisberg to dinner and showed strong interest, and by the following month had written an article on the HIV controversy. But then, as he has since admitted to a mutual contact, he ran into editorial roadblocks and ended up writing articles on the Gallo virus-stealing scandal. He has expressed a genuine desire to cover the debate over HIV, but feared the political pressures. By early 1993, these pressures finally led him to join forces against Duisberg, and he threatened to publish an article refuting his position for good. Nothing has yet happened. Since Robert Gallo's acquittal on scientific misconduct charges, Crudson has once again indicated potential interest in the HIV debate. The New York Times has mentioned Duisberg only 3 times in 7 years, every time attacking him. The Washington Post has done likewise, with 1 hostile article and 1 small neutral piece. The San Francisco Chronicle intended to cover the story until it encountered opposition from scientists in the local AIDS establishment. In 1989, Rolling Stone had commissioned a freelance writer from New York to write a Duisberg article, but then canceled it during the interview with Duisberg at his lab at the University of California at Berkeley. Harper's Magazine canceled a major article in 1990 after having commissioned it from a freelance reporter who spent 3 years on the piece. The Los Angeles Times, unlike other major newspapers, has covered the issue a few times, but each article underwent extraordinary editorial review, even when written by veteran staff reporters, ultimately being framed in terms slightly hostile to Duisberg and always accompanied by a piece attacking his position. In June of 1993, its weekly magazine published an article criticizing AZT therapy. The freelance writer had been commissioned for the piece several months earlier, but had been subjected to such a gauntlet of editors that she had to write off 9 drafts, with many key facts being deleted in the process. She calculated her final pay for that article as $3 per hour of work. The previous year, she had spent many months writing a specially commissioned article for Esquire magazine. That story had been killed altogether. One chemist who wrote to Time magazine discovered that Time, too, was consciously refusing to cover the sensational HIV debate. In a noncommittal response letter, the editor wrote, "We appreciated your call for the coverage of the theories of Peter Duisberg and have brought your comments to the attention of the appropriate editors. We have been aware of Duisberg's challenge to the mainstream concept of AIDS for several years and continue to monitor the debate he has set in motion." Then the letter referred to unpublished data supposedly refuting Duisberg's position. Again, this censorship extends to other countries. A star reporter for Germany's Bild der Wissenschaft was shocked when her article on Duisberg was canceled without explanation, while Der Spiegel went so far as to attack Duisberg in 1993 and again in 1995 without allowing him to respond. In general, smaller or independent regional periodicals have proven much more willing to cover the HIV debate than have national publications. After all, the larger media depend more heavily on access to government scientists and public health officials. Censorship in the professional literature. Having averted serious media publicity, the AIDS establishment directed its power toward isolating and neutralizing Duisberg within scientific circles. A scientist's career depends heavily on peer-reviewed grant money, peer-reviewed opportunities to publish in scientific journals, and invitations to conferences. These vulnerabilities became the targets for sanctions by AIDS officials. Robert Gallo and some other scientists began refusing, for example, to attend scientific conferences if Duisberg would be allowed to make a presentation. So in 1988, when an old colleague and friend of Duisberg's finally arranged a meeting on retroviruses on the Greek island of Crete, he dropped Duisberg's name from the announcement. Incredulous, Duisberg called back only to find that the apologetic long-term collaborator could not allow him to give a lecture, or the meeting would fall apart. Since that time, Duisberg rarely has been invited to retrovirus meetings and virtually never to AIDS conferences, despite seminal contributions to the field, including the isolation of the retroviral genome, the first analysis of the order of retroviral genes, and the discovery of the first retroviral cancer gene. Since then, however, Duisberg has received invitations to 3 major meetings to which Gallo had also been invited. In all 3 cases, Gallo carried out his threat. These included a retrovirology meeting in New York in 1989, when Gallo excused himself because of disease in the family. The next opportunity for a Duisberg-Gallo match was scheduled for a hematology meeting in Hanover, Germany in 1990. Gallo was already in Hanover for a lecture before the conference, but after a breakfast with the conference organizer and Duisberg at the beginning of the conference, Gallo suddenly disappeared, citing disease in the family for his premature departure. Disease in the family seemed to be a predictable coincidence whenever Gallo was scheduled to meet Duisberg at a public forum. The next opportunity arose at a cancer meeting in Bonn, Germany in 1993. Gallo was slated to deliver the opening lecture at the Bonn meeting, but canceled a mere 3 hours ahead of his scheduled appearance, citing disease in the family as his excuse. The notice was sent from Hamburg, only a few hundred miles away, where Gallo had lectured the previous day. After the 1987 paper in Cancer Research, publishing suddenly became unbelievably difficult for Duisberg. Papers, especially on AIDS, would constantly run into obstacles at every turn, from hostile peer reviewers to reluctant editors. Even in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, where Academy members such as Duisberg have an automatic right to publish papers without the standard peer review, he nevertheless encountered serious trouble. In June of 1988, he submitted a paper to the proceedings, providing new arguments and evidence against the HIV hypothesis. The editor promptly rejected it, citing lack of originality in the paper's viewpoint. A new editor, meanwhile, took the helm, and Duisberg invoked his right as an Academy member and protested. The new editor took up the issue, nervously pointing out the paper was controversial and insisting he could not publish it without peer review. The next several months brought three hostile reviewers, dozens of disputed points, and tense negotiations covering more than 60 pages, but finally, the paper appeared in February 1989. The paper hinted at its extraordinary history with only a special disclaimer. This paper, which reflects the author's views on the causes of AIDS, will be followed in a future issue by a paper presenting a different view of the subject. Robert Gallo was asked to write a rebuttal, but he never did. In August 1990, Duisberg submitted another paper, this time arguing that drug use is more tightly associated with AIDS than is HIV. Again, the editor promptly rejected the paper, arguing that it was too long. Forced to split the paper in two, one part documenting that AIDS was not contagious and the other that drugs are the cause, Duisberg submitted the two shorter papers. Following two peer reviews and several months of protracted haggling, the editor relented and published the less controversial one that questioned infectious AIDS. Duisberg resubmitted the other half of the paper, the one arguing that drug use causes most AIDS. This time, his paper was doomed. Although Duisberg had already taken advice from four scientific colleagues in writing it, the paper was subjected to three anonymous reviewers by the editor. Two of the three voted to block publication, one of them calling any questions of the HIV hypothesis extreme and highly dubious, and warning that the drug AIDS hypothesis has a potential for being harmful to the HIV-infected segment of the population. This particular reviewer admitted, "I am no expert in the fields concerned," and none of the three could point to factual errors in the paper. At this point, a new editor replaced the previous one, and Duisberg tried again with a modified paper. The new editor added four new reviewers who, though unable to find serious flaws, all voted to kill the paper. One reviewer even suggested the real reason was that if the paper were published, one is further tempted to blame the victim. Trying once more, Duisberg had fellow Academy member Harry Rubin submit the paper after running it by four independent reviewers, all of whom recommended changes but favored its publication. The editor completely ignored those opinions, selecting three more anonymous reviewers who again voted down the paper by late 1991. 1 year after first being sent to the proceedings, the paper was completely dead. This decision made Duisberg the second member in the 128-year history of the Academy to have a paper rejected from its journal. Apparently, the other had been Linus Pauling, who had argued vitamin C might prevent cancer. But the AIDS establishment made its most effective counterattack by going after Duisberg's funding, the lifeblood of any scientist's laboratory. In 1985, the NIH had awarded him an Outstanding Investigator Grant, OIG, a special 7-year grant designed to give accomplished scientists the freedom to explore new ideas and directions without constantly having to apply for new funding. The time for renewal application arrived in 1990, 2 years before the grant would finish. But that October, Duisberg received the shocking news. His rating by the peer review committee was so low as to guarantee the grant would be discontinued, whereas 2/3 of the competing OIG applications were approved. Though referring to Duisberg as one of the pioneers of modern retrovirology, the committee betrayed its real motives by complaining that he had ventured off to question the cause of AIDS. According to the reviewers, Dr. Duisberg has become sidetracked and can no longer be considered at the forefront of his field. More recent years have been less productive, perhaps reflecting a dilution of his efforts with non-scientific issues. The very fact that a group of top researchers would consider the questioning of orthodox views in science as non-scientific comments powerfully on how completely science has been turned upside down since it had become totally dependent on the centralization of funding in the NIH. In this case, moreover, the deck had been deliberately stacked against Duisberg. One of the 10 specially selected reviewers, too, had severe conflicts of interest. Dan Bolognese was a Burroughs Wellcome consultant who tested AZT for the company, and Flossie Wong Stahl was a former researcher for Robert Gallo. Of the remaining members, Duisberg accidentally discovered that 3 had never reviewed the grant at all, and a 4th had only given his recommendation by phone, a favorable one. Thus, it would appear that the NIH had rigged the outcome. Naturally, Duisberg protested vigorously, but received only a brush-off. Throughout the next 2 years, he waged an unceasing battle to save his grant. First, the University of California at Berkeley refused to endorse his appeal to the NIH, without which he could not legally proceed. As with most universities, virtually the largest source of income was from research grants, especially from the NIH, and the university must have feared retaliation. Duisberg also could not get a straight response from the NIH. He then turned to his congressman, Ron Dellums, whose staff aide began writing inquiry letters. The Secretary of Health and Human Services, Louis Sullivan, responded dismissively, admitting familiarity with the Duisberg case but denying any irregularities in procedure. Further correspondence brought equally vague answers from Bernadine Healy, the director of NIH. This continued for many months, but after an article in a national academic newspaper embarrassing to the university, Duisberg won university endorsement and the NIH agreed to investigate. After stalling yet another 9 months, the NIH announced in early 1993 that the grant proposal would be reviewed from scratch. For a short while, the situation seemed to be improving. Then in March, while the new committee was reviewing the grant proposal, the journal Nature suddenly published a string of articles publicized as definitive proofs of the HIV hypothesis. Michael Asher and a team of epidemiologists funded on an NIH contract from Anthony Fauci wrote a commentary asserting that among a group of 1,000 San Francisco men, only those with HIV developed AIDS, regardless of drug abuse. 2 weeks later, Fauci himself published a paper boasting that he had found large amounts of HIV hiding in the lymph nodes of infected people. A third article backed up Fauci's claim on the virus detection. At the time, Nature issued press releases advertising the papers, and the news media excitedly buzzed with the news that Duisberg's AIDS viewpoint had finally been disproved. Only months later, when the dust began to settle, did the claims begin to unravel. Asher and colleagues had used improper and misleading statistical methods on poorly collected data. Every one of the AIDS patients in Asher's study was a homosexual who had used nitrate inhalants in addition to cocaine and amphetamines, and 84% had also been on AZT prescriptions. The definitive argument to refute the drug hypothesis would have been to find a group of AIDS patients who had never used any drug. Since that was not possible, Asher and colleagues had to make an arbitrary choice between two independent AIDS correlations, HIV and drugs. Naturally, they chose antibodies against HIV as the correlation that was the cause. However, in order to make the HIV correlation 100%, Asher's data had to be adjusted in two ways. First, using the AIDS definition, one of 30 diseases plus antibodies against HIV to their advantage, Asher and colleagues left out 45 patients with AIDS-defining diseases but without HIV. This adjusted the HIV antibody AIDS correlation to 100%. Second, Asher and colleagues drew a curve showing a group of drug-free HIV-positive patients labeled seropositive, no drug use, who did not even exist in their article. For emphasis, the curve was even drawn on a blue background, which is unnecessarily expensive and very rare in a scientific journal. But the graph with the non-existent drug-free AIDS patients was faithfully reproduced by the San Francisco Chronicle and many other newspapers. Duisberg wrote to Nature inquiring about the source of the drug-free men in trying to point out the logical holes in the Asher paper, the biggest of which was Asher's attempt to refute the drug hypothesis with AIDS patients who had all used a multiplicity of drugs, including nitrates, amphetamines, cocaine, and even AZT. Indeed, Asher's AIDS patients were nothing short of walking pharmacies. The editor, John Maddox, not only refused to publish the letter, but advertised the censorship in a full-page editorial boldly entitled, "Has Duisberg a Right of Reply?" The answer, according to Maddox, was no. The editor then revealed the hidden reason behind stifling the response. Duisberg had asked unanswerable rhetorical questions. This was the editorial to which the prominent Italian virologist gleefully responded, openly calling for further censorship, as mentioned earlier. But the Lancet published the Duisberg letter inquiring about the drug-free AIDS cases, and the Genetica recently published a reanalysis of Asher's et al. Database and confirmed Duisberg's suspicion that there were no drug-free AIDS patients in Asher's study. Asher and colleagues tried to argue their way out of the dilemma, making undocumented claims in letters to The Lancet and to Science. But now, 2 years later, neither Asher nor Nature ever identified the source of the drug-free men with AIDS. Fauci's own Nature paper, boasting large amounts of virus in AIDS patients, actually analyzed just three patients who showed only tiny amounts of dormant HIV genes, even in the lymph nodes, and no infectious virus at all. Two patients contained a dormant HIV gene in 1,000 T cells, and one contained a dormant HIV gene in 100 T cells. Those were the skimpy data that inspired Nature editor Maddox to, 1. Write his own editorial, "Where the AIDS Virus Hides Away," 2. Call on 2 Bob Club members, Danny Bolognese and Howard Temin, to write yet another editorial, "Where Has HIV Been Hiding?" and 3. To launch an international press release offering a draft for an article ready for each newspaper to print. All this for a few dormant HIV genes in 3 AIDS patients. Ironically, even Asher and his colleagues later turned on Fauci, criticizing his paper in a letter published in Nature for its skimpy data on virus in AIDS patients. The review committee again voted down Duisberg's grant proposal a few months later. This time, the rating was low enough to discontinue the grant, but not so startlingly low as to appear abnormal. Nor did any reviewers hold obvious conflicts of interest other than being retrovirologists studying HIV and animal viruses. They did, however, complain about Duisberg's questioning attitude as the major obstacle to funding him and singled out his AIDS debate as an example. Since then, every one of his 17 peer-reviewed grant applications to other federal, state, or private agencies, whether for AIDS research on AZT and other drugs or for cancer research, has been turned down. The most spectacular example is the fate of a grant proposal for testing the health hazards of nitrate inhalants, or poppers, in mice. Duisberg had applied with an internationally respected inhalation toxicologist, Professor Otto Raab, from the University of California at Davis. The proposal had actually been inspired by Harry Haverkos, director of the Office on AIDS at the National Institute on Drug Abuse, NIDA, during a visit to Duisberg's lab in 1993. Haverkos had long favored nitrates as a cause of AIDS, particularly of Kaposi sarcoma. To advance the nitrate AIDS hypothesis, Haverkos had organized a conference on the subject and then edited the conference's proceedings for the NIDA monograph, Health Hazards of Nitrate Inhalants. The Duisberg-Raab proposal followed the classical reductionist approach in which scientists try to reduce a complex problem to a single cause by eliminating competing alternatives. In this case, the proposal set out to distinguish between nitrate inhalants and retroviruses as causes of AIDS-defining diseases in experimental mice. However, despite having a high-level ally in the federal agency, the proposal was turned down. The AIDS study section at the NIDA that reviewed the application quickly realized the imminent danger to the virus AIDS hypothesis. The project could prove that nitrate inhalants are sufficient causes of immunodeficiency pneumonia, Kaposi sarcoma, and other AIDS diseases, and would thus discredit the HIV hypothesis. They knew what to do, and did it in 1993, in 1994, and again in 1995. The review committee acknowledged the proposal's strength, but refused to award it any rating at all. Not recommended for further consideration. The only consistent argument against the proposal was the lack of preliminary experiments, but preliminary experiments are not a requirement for a grant application. An innovative idea, exhaustive knowledge of the literature, and professional competence are. Informed about the latest rejection of the Popper grant, even Haverkos was dismayed, but he offered a possibly life-saving lesson of grantsmanship. Haverkos advised to avoid the AIDS issue altogether and to rewrite the application as a response to a specific NIDA program announcement requesting research on the medical and health consequences of drug abuse issued by himself and the director of NIDA. The announcement invites independent investigators to study a possible link between inhaled nitrate use and Kaposi sarcoma and encourages studies of nitrate inhalant and other drug use to determine relationships between substance abuse and health outcomes, pointing out that animal studies are encouraged, exactly what Duisberg and Robb had proposed for 3 years in a row. Haverkos even offered to bulletproof the proposal by rewriting it himself. Unfortunately, he sighed, it would be hard to rewrite the name Duisberg. The proposal was resubmitted for an NIDA review in the fall of 1995. On November 21, 1995, even this application, which responded to NIDA's request for research on the medical consequences of nitrate inhalants, was rejected. Privately, two high-ranking NIDA officials acknowledged to Duisberg that neither NIDA nor any other federal institute was sponsoring even one study on the long-term effects of recreational drug use. Given that we are more than 10 years into an epidemic that can't be dissociated from drug use, even with more than $35 billion spent, this is a remarkable situation. The occasions of these private contacts were two recent NIDA conferences on AIDS and drug abuse, one in Gaithersburg, Maryland in May 1994, and the other in Scottsdale, Arizona in June 1995. Thus, it would seem that drugs are acceptable topics as possible causes of AIDS at NIDA conferences, but not acceptable study objects for HIV dissidents. The chilling effects of silencing tactics extend even onto the campus itself. In March 1993, Duisberg was scheduled to give a keynote speech on AIDS to a Los Angeles meeting of alumni of the University of California at Berkeley. He flew in the evening before, only to learn that three colleagues called up the conference organizers demanding that he be balanced with an opposing speaker or be canceled. The speech was nevertheless delivered as planned and received an enthusiastic response from the audience. Among those who applauded was University of California Berkeley Chancellor Chang Lin Tien, who is a staunch supporter of academic freedom. In private conversations, Tien considered alternative views the only chance to solve the AIDS crisis. Duisberg eventually discovered that one of the three professors who protested his speech was a member of his own department in charge of advising graduate students. Several fellow professors maneuver against Duisberg in various ways. His promotions and pay are blocked, and his teaching assignments are restricted to difficult undergraduate laboratory courses rather than the coveted graduate lecture courses. While other faculty sit on committees governing teaching policies, courses, and curricula, speaking invitations, and hiring of faculty, Duisberg is placed in charge of the annual picnic committee. More important, graduate students are discouraged from entering Duisberg's lab during their decision-making first year, advice that can be psychologically intimidating to such inexperienced students. Under the condition of anonymity, several students have confessed to such pressures more than once. By 1994, Nature editor Maddox had identified himself so much with the HIV hypothesis that he wanted more than the symptomatic treatments of HIV dissent with censorship and the never-ending string of new studies. Maddox wanted a cure. Maddox had made his wishes perfectly clear in editorials, calling on the dissidents to concede defeat. When he, Duisberg, offers a text for publication that can be authenticated, It will, if possible, be published, not least in the hope and expectation that his next offering will be an admission of recent error. The danger for the Duisburgs of this world is that they will be left high and dry, championing a cause that will have ever fewer adherents as time passes. Now may be the time for them to recant. Those that have made the running in the long controversy over HIV and AIDS, Dr. Peter Duisburg of Berkeley, California in particular, have a heavy responsibility that can only be discharged by a public acknowledgement of error, honest or otherwise, and the sooner the better. Maddox's opportunity to defeat HIV dissent for good offered itself in September 1994. At that time, Duisburg got a call from an old friend who is now a high-ranking geneticist at the NIH for an urgent personal meeting on a professional matter. An excited Duisburg asked what professional matter could be so private that it required a personal meeting. Was it about AIDS? About cancer? The voice at the other end of the phone said the subject was simply too hot to be discussed over the phone, but he could be in San Francisco in 24 hours. The next day, the two met at the opera in San Francisco. After some small talk about the old days, the topic quickly shifted to AIDS, and suddenly, a paper was on the table at the Opera Cafe. HIV causes AIDS. Koch's postulates fulfilled. The paper was signed by three authors: Duisburg's friend, another NIH researcher specializing in epidemiology, and surprisingly by Duisburg as well. It had been commissioned by Nature editor John Maddox. The NIH geneticist argued that by now Duisburg could safely sign on because the evidence for HIV had grown so overwhelming that nobody would listen to arguments against it, no matter how reasonable these arguments were. By continuing his opposition to HIV, Duisburg would even risk his credentials for having discovered cancer genes. In his touching appeal, the geneticist deplored that the scientific community had ostracized Duisburg without a fair trial, and that the proposed paper would open the doors for Duisburg's re-entry into the establishment. The paper would be in press the next Tuesday. When the NIH geneticist would have dinner with Maddox in London, provided the authors would reach consensus on the subject. With a promise for a carefully considered decision before the Tuesday meeting with Maddox, Duisburg returned his friend to the airport. The decision was to convert the paper in two, one essentially unchanged but without Duisburg's name, the other a rebuttal written by Duisburg. This proposal would have put both sides of the debate on an equal footing, but it proved to be the end of this most unusual invitation to publish in Nature. The Changing Tide. Although the war on AIDS has achieved a life of its own, its original momentum flowed largely from the power of David Baltimore, the co-chairman of the Confronting AIDS Committee. But despite his many allies, even he ultimately proved to be vulnerable. Baltimore's reign began quietly unraveling in 1986, but few people noticed at the time. An immunology paper he published that year with several colleagues came under fire when one of the authors stepped forward to charge fraudulent research that some of the reported experiments were never really performed. Baltimore's clout prevented investigations for several months. Then, despite the evidence, both MIT and Tufts University cleared the paper of wrongdoing. The NIH spent a full year probing the matter and also exonerated the authors in January 1989. Disturbed, Michigan Congressman John Dingell held hearings to revive the case. By May of 1989, Baltimore finally ran into serious problems. Dingell had prodded the Secret Service to investigate the experimental notebooks kept by one of Baltimore's fellow authors, Teresa Amanishi Carey. She was caught having faked her data, using ink not in existence when she supposedly carried out the experiments. Now the NIH reopened its own investigation. Baltimore's influential friends came to his rescue. Dozens of top scientists campaigned on his behalf, including testifying to Congress. That October, as his reputation was suffering, he even received a career-rescuing offer from the prestigious Rockefeller University in New York. The Board of Trustees, prodded by wealthy banker and fellow member David Rockefeller, asked Baltimore to serve as president of the university. The faculty opposed the move, embarrassed at the thought of having a fraud-tainted leader. In fact, said Richard M. Furlaud, chairman of the board, the opposition was so strong that Baltimore actually withdrew his candidacy because of it. But the board and David Rockefeller weren't giving up. Farlad and Rockefeller flew to Cambridge to persuade him to change his mind. Mr. Rockefeller said, "Look, we still think you're the right person to do the job," recalls Farlad. And then he accepted the role of candidate. Over strenuous objections, the trustees pushed the nomination through and handed the presidency to Baltimore in July 1990. Rockefeller himself pulled strings to have Baltimore invited into such exclusive private clubs as the New York-based Council on Foreign Relations. The tensions at the university simmered for another year before the NIH finally released its report on the fraud probe, which after 2 years of delays concluded that some of the data were indeed faked. Baltimore suddenly had to retract the paper, but dismayed his colleagues by publicly defending it anyway. The controversy erupted into open rebellion as three of the university's top scientists left to take jobs elsewhere. Again, Baltimore's friends stepped in, and David Rockefeller donated $20 million to the university as evidence of his absolute confidence in Baltimore's presidency. The money briefly held back the opposition, but when yet another leading scientist announced his departure, Baltimore finally had to resign as president. On December 3, 1991, he retreated from the ruins of his former position to continue HIV research in his lab. Confronting AIDS has not withstood the test of time much better. Even though AIDS officials still refer to its authority, the report has gradually been tarnished by its failures. For example, it predicted a total of more than 270,000 American AIDS cases through 1991, including 74,000 new cases during 1991, and a grand total of 179,000 deaths by that time. Using the same 1985 CDC definition of AIDS, only 167,000 AIDS cases had actually been tallied through 1991, a little more than half the predicted level. The CDC filled most of the gap by expanding the AIDS definition, but such tricks cannot work forever. Ultimately, the war on AIDS has failed to save lives, the only test that really counts. Condoms, sterile needles, and widespread HIV testing have made no measurable impact except to arouse frustration and despair among the HIV positives and fear among the HIV negatives. And such toxic chemotherapies as AZT have been recklessly prescribed to people who might otherwise have lived. The NIH, the CDC, and the virus hunters have been winning this war, but the rest of us have been losing. To win the war on AIDS, one must first know its cause. The proverbial strategy of first find the cause, then fight the cause, is the only rational strategy to win that war. The next chapter proves that the cause of AIDS is already known, and that the scientific basis for a rational war on AIDS is already at hand, even though the evidence is obstructed by the propaganda of the HIV/AIDS establishment.